Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello all, Eric Rivenis with the Most Notorious Podcast here. Each week I interview an author or historian about a historical true crime, tragedy, or disaster. Subject matter ranges from gunslingers to Gilded Age murder to gangsters to fires to pirates to wild prison breaks. My guests bring their incredible knowledge directly to you. Please subscribe to Most Notorious on your favorite podcast app. Cheers, and have a safe tomorrow.
Southern Gothic is a podcast that explores the history behind some of the American South's darkest days, greatest mysteries, and most chilling ghost stories. Before the Civil War, most of the free people in Alabama made their living farming cotton. But after the war ended and plantation owners could no longer profit off the backs of enslaved men, a new era began, one that embraced industrial development. After all, Alabama was not only home to large, previously untapped deposits of coal, limestone, and iron ore, the exact ingredients needed for the manufacture of iron and steel, but it was also the only place in the country where all three were found in such close proximity. So investors and entrepreneurs flocked to the state. Blast furnaces were built, railroad tracks were laid, and Birmingham, the upstart city at the center of it all, grew so fast that it earned the nickname Magic City. Between 1875 and 1900, Alabama's coal production grew from 67,000 tons in a year to 8.4 million, while its pig iron output increased from 11,000 tons in 1872 to more than 1 million at the turn of the century. Of course, a large labor force was also needed to do this difficult and dangerous work, and many who came to fill those roles had been sharecroppers, both white and black, who hoped to escape their impoverished rural communities with a steady paying job. Others were European immigrants, folks willing to do work that most wouldn't. Eventually, though, when these tradesmen began to form labor unions and strike for higher wages and better working conditions in these incredibly unsafe mines and furnaces, the industrialist owners found a simple way to not only replace them, but also minimize their expenses. Convict labor. The businessmen quite literally leased men from the state and various counties, paying a fixed price to the government so that they could force men, most of whom lacked any mining experience, to labor without any regard for their safety or health. It was a system fraught with corruption, greed, and racism. Unlike enslaved men before the war, whose lives were at least valuable to their owners as purchased assets, these men, deemed criminals, were treated as entirely replaceable. The business didn't have to take care of them. If a man died, they could always just rent another. This disregard for human life that led to the worst mining accident in Alabama history, an explosion at the Banner Mine that resulted in the death of 128 miners, almost all of whom were black men imprisoned under the notorious convict lease labor system. Yet even this catastrophic loss of life, as horrific as it was, did little to change the minds of those in power. My name is Brandon Schecksnyder, and you are listening to Southern Gothic. It was a rainy Saturday morning on April 8, 1911, when the day shift of convict laborers arrived at the Banner Mine from their nearby prison camp at about 6 a.m. But the rain wouldn't bother them, as after the men shuffled past those leaving from the night crew, they would begin 10 hours of back-breaking work deep in the darkness of the mine without any exposure to the outside world. Besides, it was Saturday, so this was their last shift of the week. Tomorrow would be a day of rest, and they didn't really have any choice anyway. At the time, the process of removing coal had four steps. First, they'd carve a 3 to 4 foot wedge into the face of a coal seam with a pickaxe. They would then drill holes in it for powder charges to be placed inside that men called shot fires would ignite, blasting out chunks of coal for others to then come and shovel into carts that mules pulled along tracks out to the mine's entrance, where the coal was separated and processed. This particular procedure was known as the room and pillar method, and it was common all the way up until the 1930s when mechanical loaders began replacing the difficult job of filling up those carts. But in many ways, the physically taxing nature of loading coal was hardly the only challenge. The mine lacked any natural light, and the air was constantly filled with dust and gas. To counteract this, mines were engineered to have two entrances with large fans to constantly push fresh air in. But sometimes that explosive gas built up, and accidents happened. At 6:30 a.m., an explosion and blast of flame shook the Banner Mine. Five men were blown to pieces and killed instantly, including a convict who was doing the electrical work and four free men who were hired on as shot firers. But this was only the beginning of the horrors to follow. The loud blast and rumble resonated through the mine, the air quickly filled with dust, and the 20-foot industrial fan that was absolutely necessary to supply miners inside with a fresh supply of air, well, it slowed to a stop. Experienced men inside knew what this meant as soon as they heard the explosion, and that if they didn't act fast, they'd succumb to the rise of black damp, a mixture of carbon dioxide and other unbreathable gases that suffocated everyone who came into contact with it. So they yelled for their fellow prisoners to run for safety, and about 40 men made it out to daylight unharmed. But aware of the need for swift action, a little more than a dozen of them took it upon themselves to turn back and try to help others to safety. But with every second that passed, the conditions inside grew more and more treacherous. J. Flavius Irwin, a company man for the Louisville and Nashville Railroad, alerted the corporate offices of the Pratt Consolidated Company in Birmingham as soon as he heard the explosion and saw that fan come to a stop.
Banner mines were blown up just now. About 200 men in there and killed.
At that point, Irwin had no way of actually knowing how many lives would be lost that day. But the message was certainly not overblown when it came to the scope of the emergency at hand. A rescue train was immediately sent from Birmingham to assist, but by the time they arrived, the mine was eerily quiet and a thick cloud of dust still hung in the air. Some of the men who had led the initial rescue attempts filled company officials in on the situation. Fallen rocks had blocked a number of corridors, and the gas had already built up so much that they found dead miners inside who looked as if they had merely fallen asleep where they sat. State Mine Inspector James Hillhouse then led a team of 23 men back into the mine, including 6 rescuers and 16 convicts who volunteered to help. But it became obvious awful quick that, with the air the way it was, they weren't going to get too far in. So they loaded several of their dead colleagues into carts and brought them out before they turned back and pushed deeper into the mine. By that afternoon, though, the gas had taken far too great a toll on these men, whose number was dwindling as a result, and even Inspector Hillhouse himself had to be pulled out after falling unconscious twice. It was clear that by now, the chance of any of the miners inside to have survived was practically non-existent. So the men turned their attention to getting the fan back up and running. Then, once clean air could be pushed back in, they'd go to work restabilizing the shaft and continue with the grim task of bringing the dead back up to the surface. The following morning, the Montgomery Advertiser described the circumstances from that long day in harrowing detail.
118 men are tonight entombed in the Banner Mine, and but 3 bodies have been brought to the surface following a terrific explosion. The fatal afterdamp which followed the explosion has so far kept the rescuers from penetrating the mine, although they have been far enough in the interior to see the gruesome pile of human bodies huddled together near the shaft. It is estimated that about 20 men are in this pile. Officials of the Pratt Consolidated Company, which owns the mine, have tonight practically abandoned hope of bringing any of those now below the surface alive. This afternoon, they can be heard knocking on the pipes below, but there's an ominous stillness tonight, which indicates that the suffocating afterdamp has done its deadly work.
By Sunday morning, the rain had stopped, and crowds of curious onlookers began to arrive at the scene to watch as carloads of dead bodies were brought to the surface. They were then cleaned at the prison and their bodies embalmed, a task that was apparently so overwhelming, surviving convicts had to assist in the process. After that, unless relatives showed up to claim them, the men were unceremoniously buried in a long trench on the mine's premises. It took 6 long days for the last body to finally be pulled from the mine. And once that dust had finally settled and was made public, 128 men were killed in the explosion at the Banner, and almost all of them were African-American prisoners who had been leased to the mining company for cheap labor. The Banner Mine was located northeast of Birmingham near Littleton in Jefferson County. Owned by the Pratt Consolidated Coal Company, it opened in 1904, and within 10 years it became the crown jewel of the company's 54 mines. Not only was Banner the first in the state to have electric lighting, electric haulage, and electric coal cutting, but according to Robert David Ward and William Warren Rogers in their book, Convicts, Coal, and the Banner Mine Tragedy, quote, "The Banner, as its name implied, was the safest mine in Alabama. It was owned and managed by men of impeccable credentials. And yet, the unthinkable had happened." But y'all, I'm not sure that was really something to brag about, as Alabama had an absolutely abysmal record of mine safety. More than 1,000 deaths had taken place in the state's mines during the first decade of the 20th century alone. Not to mention, only a week prior to the explosion, two convict laborers died at Banner after inhaling gas. Obviously, Pratt Consolidated was quick to cover their liability in the aftermath of the disaster, but several theories were floated in the press as to what had caused the explosion in the first place. Based on the destruction, inspectors were able to narrow down where the blast had ignited, and as such, it was believed that blasting powder had either ignited a gas buildup or was simply handled too close to an open lamp. Another was that John Wright, the convict doing electrical work that day, had sparked two wires, either igniting standing gas or the black powder, setting that lethal chain of events in motion. This was probably the most likely, based on the fact of where his body was found and the condition it was in. That being said, it might also be that it took the blame off of Pratt Consolidated and placed it on an individual's negligence. Of course, that individual was a convict, and that part of the equation did not go unnoticed. One reporter wrote, quote, "When I viewed the cold faces of the dead black men, I wondered then were it now better for them? For it was certainly the last escape, the one way of beating justice, fate, or perhaps injustice." Now y'all, while on the surface it might seem acceptable to put felons to work in order to pay for their incarceration, most of the men leased by the Pratt Company for the Banner Mine were convicted of meager crimes with less than 3-year sentences that we can probably all agree did not warrant what was effectively the death penalty. On top of that, in many cases, the laws that these men broke were intentionally enacted and selectively enforced to uphold a system that Pulitzer Prize-winning author Douglas A. Blackman and other historians explicitly refer to as slavery by another name.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Y'all, I want to take a quick minute to tell you about one of my favorite nonprofit organizations here in Middle Tennessee. It's called Poster Nashville. Now, this organization supports people during times of housing or medical crises by providing compassionate, temporary care for their pets. That's right. Poster helps secure loving homes for beloved little furballs when their human companions are going through things that might otherwise cause them to have to give them up. But since Poster began back in 2020, they've been able to reunite nearly 250 pets with their loving pet parents after they were able to secure housing, keeping families together through tough times. Of course, y'all, I have to say from personal experience, it's been an awesome program to be around. My kids and I have been fortunate enough to hang out with some of the pups, and trust me, what Poster is doing through a devoted network of volunteers is absolutely heartwarming. So if you'd like to help, Poster is in the middle of their annual fundraiser right now, trying to hit a goal of $20,000, and it would mean the world to me if you'd consider helping us get there. All you got to do is visit southerngothicmedia.com/bark. That's right, southerngothicmedia.com/bark. On December 6, 1865, the 13th Amendment to the United States Constitution was ratified and the abolishment of slavery was finally the law of the land. But for many white Southerners and former Confederates, as soon as the Reconstruction era ended and the federal government removed its military presence, they took it upon themselves to push back against the civil rights reforms. As for the scope of what we're discussing today, I'm not going to go too deep into Jim Crow laws or black codes as a whole, which were meant to ensure African Americans were second-class citizens through the means of suppressing their right to vote and forcing segregation. Rather, we're going to focus on the loophole in the 13th Amendment that allowed these post-war white supremacists to perpetuate an exploitative labor system built on the backs of what should have been free African-American men and women. The amendment read simply,
"Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as punishment for crime, whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction."
That's right. While the Constitution may have outlawed involuntary servitude in the form of slavery, there was an exemption that allowed state and local governments to use prisoners to fill labor shortages. Now, some have claimed that this was merely a way for impoverished states like Alabama to pay for the incarceration of convicts without forcing taxpayers to foot the bill, but even if that was the case at first, it definitely was not for long. The idea of cheap labor that couldn't strike or unionize was awful attractive to businessmen, and as the demand for convict labor grew, states recognized the potential revenue stream that it generated, and in places like Alabama, they weren't going to turn that down. In 1874, its first year leasing convicts, the state of Alabama made $14,000. But by 1890, that profit had grown to $164,000, an amount equivalent to over $4 million today. Now, how did they make that happen? Well, they enacted laws that specifically targeted African Americans in both sentencing and selective enforcement, outlawing trivial acts like walking along a railroad or spitting in public, effectively criminalizing everyday life. Dr. Khalil Gibran Muhammad, a professor of history, race, and public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School, says one of the most notorious ways they made this happen was by increasing punishments for what were otherwise minor misdemeanors, considered black crimes.
One of the most infamous set of laws to come out of this period were the pig laws, passed in Mississippi, Florida, Georgia, and Alabama, enhancing penalties for what had been previously misdemeanor offenses to now felony offenses.
Mississippi was the first to enact the pig laws on April 5, 1876, when the new post-Reconstruction legislature revised the criminal code and lowered the threshold for what was considered grand larceny, making petty theft punishable by up to 5 years in prison, specifically providing, quote, "that it shall be grand larceny to feloniously steal a hog, pig, cow, calf, yearling steer, bull, sheep, lamb, goat, or kid of the value of $1 or more." Clearly, this was meant to incarcerate men for longer, not as a way to prevent crime, but a way to fill labor camps. Yet, according to Douglas Blackman, this wasn't even the most oppressive and exploitative law of them all.
The most powerful, the most damaging of all these laws were the vagrancy statutes. In every Southern state, you became a criminal if you could not prove at any given moment that you were employed.
as early as 1866, convict leasing began in Alabama, and by the turn of the century, black men made up about 97% of Alabama's county convicts. As I said, I'm not trying to absolve all of the prisoners of their crimes, but there's no doubt that this system over-exaggerated African-American criminality for the sake of labor. The extended sentences weren't even the worst part, though. What made the convict leasing system truly horrific was that it gave tremendous power to the owners of companies to do what they wanted with the prisoners under the guise that they were felons, so they deserved it. And when it came to companies who were constantly fighting labor disputes over pay and harsh working conditions, this was exploited to an extreme that I don't think we can ever truly understand. Men were forced to work in a number of industries, laboring at farms, lumber yards, manufacturing facilities, railroad construction sites, and even on state roads. But the largest user of prison laborers were mines. And the folks who leased the most men were the Tennessee Coal, Iron, and Railroad Company, one of the original 12 listed in the Dow Jones Industrial Index, as well as John T. Milner and James W. Sloss, the two men who were essentially the forefathers, or should I say godfathers, of the Birmingham steel industry. As such, conditions in the mine were particularly gruesome. The process of mining itself was still fairly primitive, and obviously, since we've already discussed the explosion at Banner, the work was incredibly dangerous. In addition to the violent explosions and toxic gases released from the coal itself, the conditions they labored in was pretty gruesome. Obviously, the dust from coal was pervasive, but the mines were also incredibly damp, and standing water was a real issue, as men were forced to work all day standing in it up to their ankles. Not to mention, this water was also what they drank from, and as a result, disease ran rampant through the populations. Long hours also meant that many of these men went weeks or maybe even months without seeing daylight, and to top it all off, they were often chained together and forced to endure whippings, torture, and verbal abuse. In many ways, these convicts were enduring treatment far worse than their enslaved ancestors had.
It was never in the economic interest of a slave owner to kill his own slaves or to abuse them so terribly that they couldn't work anymore. So their economic value protected them in certain ways. After the Civil War, someone working these kind of forced laborers would push them to the very limits of human endurance.
Many of these men were quite literally worked to death. But in the eyes of the company, if one died, they'd just replace them with another, resulting in some Alabama prison camps' death rates hitting 30 to 40% per year. Eventually, as the 20th century went on, negative publicity about the treatment of convicts and events like the Banner Mine explosion became more prevalent. So southern states began to abolish their convict leasing programs. But Alabama was the last state to do so. And it wasn't even what happened at Banner Mine that softened the state legislature's hearts. In fact, within 2 weeks of the explosion, new convicts were sent back to work in the mine without any changes to ensure that disaster would not strike again. And then, later that year, 300 more prisoners were reassigned to Banner from the Tennessee Coal, Iron, and Railroad Company's mine after the company failed to turn in its paperwork to the state on time. It wasn't till 1928 that this shameful chapter in history came to an end, and the convict lease labor system was abolished in the state of Alabama, the last state in the nation to do so.
Flat Top, Alabama, July 2nd. Strains a swing loose, sweet chariot, and all my troubles are over. wafted from shafts of coal mines here Saturday as 800 convicts completed their last task under the Alabama Convict Lease System, a practice of more than 20 years standing. Condemned as a relic of barbarism, the convict leasing system ends at midnight after a fight which lasted for 13 years. Boss, I'm no longer in slavery. And other expressions were addressed to the official by the dusky prisoners as they broke camp. 56 were made happier still when the director of the state convict department gave them paroles as a reward for faithful and efficient work.
Today, the deadly explosion at the Banner Mine is hardly remembered in mainstream history books, and when it is, it's often done in passing, a brief example or anecdote of not only the horrific dangers of industrialization in the New South, but also as part of the shameful legacy of convict leasing in American history. My name is Brandon Schecksnyder, and you are listening to Southern Gothic. Southern Gothic is an independent podcast produced by siblings Brianne and Brandon Schecksnyder. If you're a fan of the show and would like more content, be sure to join us over on Patreon or become a premium subscriber on the Apple Podcast app. There, you'll receive access to both ad-free and monthly bonus episodes. For more info on Southern Gothic, be sure to visit southerngothicmedia.com today. And as always, thanks for listening.
Lucky Later Shacks.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Have you ever wondered who the Mary was from Bloody Mary? If the Loch Ness Monster was real? Or if Ouija boards actually worked? On each episode of the family-friendly Unspookable, we look at the histories and mysteries behind your favorite scary stories, myths, and urban legends to get the real stories behind the scares. Want to solve your next mystery? Find and follow Unspookable now, wherever you get your podcasts.